Hello, and welcome to Decent Jobs on a Living Planet, an environmental podcast where we talk to everyone from experts to activists about just transition and what it means from a Scottish perspective. Okay, welcome back to the podcast. Perhaps the last in this series. Joining us, we have two speakers today, sharing diverse experiences being part of unionised workplaces. One working for UCU, who's our first speaker, Larissa, and Kate Whitaker joining us in the second half to share some of her experiences working for Friends of the Earth Scotland, an NGO, what it's like being an activist working for an NGO, a bit about how she got into that work and what it's like on the inside. And the difference we'll be hearing in this episode will relate to the difference between a really large national networked kind of union like the UCU, which is engaged in ongoing industrial action, and what it would be like to be part of a much smaller unionized workplace such as Friends of the Earth in the third sector. So really excited to be joined by Larissa and Kate for this episode. And yeah, we'll just get to it. So hi, Larissa. Thanks for joining us.
I just wanted to maybe hear a little bit about your backgrounds. Maybe tell us your pronouns, what union you're involved with, and yeah, a bit about your background and what it is that you do.
Hi. So my name is Larissa. I'm using the pronouns she, her, and I am part of UCU, so that's the University and College Union, because I work as a hourly paid tutor at the University of Edinburgh.
Right, yeah, Brian. And when did you join the UCU?
I joined the UCU 5 years ago when I first became an hourly paid tutor at the university.
All right, Brian. And the UCU has obviously been quite active this year and last year and over the course of the past few years, really. But could you tell us a bit about your experiences maybe over the last 5 years since you joined the union? What kind of things have been organised? What kind of activities? How have you been involved?
Yeah, so we've actually had two different industrial disputes going on in the last 5 years. So when I joined 5 years ago, there was already one ongoing dispute about pensions because there were attempts to cut our pension scheme and the union disagreed with that because mm-hmm. I think everyone should have a fair, good pension when they retire. And so that was already ongoing. But then soon after, so actually in the same year that I joined, there was another dispute that started, which was about pay and working conditions. The main issues there were trying to address the decrease in pay in the sector, addressing pay inequalities, but also eradicating the use of precarious contracts, which is a big problem in our sector, that there is a lot of hourly paid contracts like the one that I'm on, but also fixed term contracts that give people very little security and stability. And so we've had these two disputes going on for over 5 years now. And as a member, I've been involved in the different rounds of strikes that have been going on. So that's meant like helping getting the vote out. So telling other people to go and vote for the disputes, discussing with people what's going on, because it can be quite confusing. And doing all sorts of other things around picket lines and informing students. Yeah, there's a lot of boring work also involved with striking and being a union member, but some nice exciting work too.
Yeah, maybe tell us a little bit about the latter part. Like, what's it like being part of quite a highly unionized workplace? Are most people in your sector sort of all on board with the union, or does it feel highly unionized, and what's it like? Is there kind of a community or solidarity there?
Yeah, it varies quite a lot between different departments within the university and between universities.
Right.
I'm quite lucky because I'm in the most highly unionized department of the university, right, which is School of Social and Political Science.
Makes sense.
So, yeah, makes sense. And so we have like over half of our staff are part of the UCU. And amongst the people that do the same job as me, so people who are hourly paid tutors, I think it's way more than half for union members. And that's in part because we have been doing a lot of organizing locally in the last few years, trying to get more tutors into the union, trying to also focus on the issues that people are facing specifically in our workplace.
Right.
Sometimes the bigger disputes, they can feel a bit complex, and there's all these negotiations going on that can feel a bit removed from our kind of day-to-day issues, even though they are very clearly linked.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been focusing on some local issues too, like office spaces and the pay that we get for marking assignments. And there's been some wins there too, which has been good. Like, we get paid more now per assignment than we did before.
Oh, right.
Really good for per hour pay. But there's still a lot of bigger issues going on that need to be addressed at a much higher level.
Indeed, ongoing action. Yeah. Did you vote yes in the recent ballot?
I have voted yes. Yeah. There's re-ballots going on currently to extend our mandate for strike action, because even after these many, many rounds of strikes that we've had, our employers are still not willing to negotiate in good faith, which is very demoralizing. And I don't want to pretend that everyone is in a great mood right now. It can be quite difficult to be part of a union when the struggle just is quite long. And
that makes sense. Yeah. On that topic, I was going to ask as well, maybe what the biggest challenges and successes have been since being part of the UCU, but it feels like the challenges you mentioned there are very relevant.
Yeah, I would say the biggest challenge has been finding effective new ways to push our employer to listen to our demands, which is an ongoing discussion within the union too. Obviously, we have the tool of strike action, which is a very strong one, but there's also other tools are being discussed right now, such as a marking boycott, which is not something that we have done nationally before, but people feel, and I do too, that we need stronger actions right now to really make our employer feel that we can't continue like this. And that's a big challenge, because it involves a lot of discussion at all levels, and it can be hard not to lose people in that process, because it's such a big organization, and you actually need to speak to people at all levels. And that's quite a big challenge, to have good processes where people can actually all feel heard and understand what's going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what were your biggest success then?
Our biggest successes, I would say, are our local wins, the things that we have done in our workplace specifically. So in my department, where we have increased the rates that people get for marking assignments, and we've also gotten additional hours paid for training, both of which have helped reduce the amount of unpaid work that people do. But there's still a lot of unpaid work that tutors are expected to do, and that's in part of the bigger dispute that we're trying to reduce that.
Absolutely. You touched on it there, but I was going to ask, you know, what's the main differences between the kind of more local branch that you might be a part of, the kind of, you know, colleagues and different people that you interact with on a more day-to-day basis, versus the UCU, which is obviously a very broad national union? And what are the main differences between those two parts of the union? And what's the communication like sometimes between them both?
There's multiple levels, as you said. It's like there's my department in a very narrow sense, and there's my bigger department, my school, in which we have local union meetings. Like right now, we have meetings to talk about how we might want to prepare for a marking boycott if that happens. But we're still waiting to hear whether that's being decided at a national level, because it's not a decision that we would take just in our department, but we still have to prepare for it locally. So we're having these meetings locally, for example. And then at branch level, so that's the branch for the university, there's other branch level meetings that take place where we discuss what the issues are that people have in different parts of the university and how people feel about a marking boycott, for example. And that then informs what the delegates from the branch take to the branch delegate meetings nationally. And that then again is what's taking place in other meetings. So it can be, there's all these levels that are connected through different meetings. And I guess the challenge is to make sure that everyone is informed and that people also have time to go to all these meetings, because it can be a lot, especially when you have two different disputes ongoing.
Right, absolutely. And feeling represented. Yeah, lots of moving parts, definitely. And you mentioned that sometimes the mood can be quite demoralized. But what was it like actually being out on strike with your colleagues? Was the feeling still frustration, or was there quite a lot of joy and conviviality there? What was it like being on strike?
There's definitely always a mix of feelings. There's anger at the employer that we have to be on the picket lines, but there's also a lot of joy that comes from the solidarity of being out there together and from the conversations that happen on picket lines. I often find that picket lines are some of the most interesting spaces in our workplace, because that's where you can actually ask much bigger political questions and get into political debates with your colleagues. And there's all kinds of learning that takes place there. Like, people do teach outs on picket lines.
Yeah, right.
That's great, because you can learn from each other and have great discussions. And even like people play music and we do dancing on the picket line. There's all kinds of things that we do when we have to stand outside for hours in the cold.
Absolutely. <It's creative. laughs> It's great to hear about those kind of the diversity of experiences of what it's like being on strike. It's not always just so grim and serious. It can also sometimes be it's a very welcoming environment a lot of the time as well, right? So what would you say to young people that maybe aren't part of a union at the moment or aren't sure how to join one? Or if they're a student that are looking to support striking teachers, then what would be the best way of doing that?
If they are a student at a university where staff are on strike, I would always encourage people to join a picket line. They're always very welcoming spaces, and we love it when students come and discuss things with us, because the problems that students face at our universities are very much interlinked with what we face as staff members. And if they are a young person working in a different workplace, then I would always encourage them to speak to other people that work there and find out if there is a union, or if maybe there have been attempts to unionize before and there's ways to pick that up. Because often that people have thought about these things already, and it's really good just to speak to each other about that and see what comes from it. And if there is no union, get in touch with the relevant union for your sector.
All right, that's great. Thanks, Larissa. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with your ongoing strike action.
Thanks very much.
Okay, hello. Now I'm joined by our next speaker, Kate Whitaker, working at Friends of the Earth in the third sector, and she's going to share with us some of her experiences and what it's like being in the unionised third sector. So hi, Kate. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice one. Do you want to just share with us maybe a bit about your background, how you got working for the third sector, and maybe how you got into activism and how those two things kind of connect?
I kind of fell into it, really. I was involved in a lot of like student activism and various kind of climate and anti-capitalist and other projects when I was like in my early 20s, and then started volunteering for Young Friends of the Earth Scotland, a job as the coordinator, and then 6 years later, I'm still at Friends of the Earth Scotland, but now I work on kind of national activism and movement building with local groups and communities across the country.
Fantastic. Okay, cool. And Friends of the Earth, that's a unionised workspace?
Yeah, so we got union recognition in September 2020. We are with Unite and we're in the not-for-profit sector. Relatively recent process that was led by quite a lot of people who are still in the organization. But we've had, I guess 3 years of being a kind of functioning workplace union, which has been a really, really great experience, I think, for most people who've been part of it.
Brilliant. Yeah. Do you want to share any experiences that have happened so far in that union, or maybe the process of putting it together if you were a part of that? Or share some insights into unionization in the third sector and some of the things that why it was necessary and all that kind of thing.
Actually, in general, the kind of charity third sector, I think, is like currently increasingly getting unionized, which I think is really exciting to see. It's been a sector that some of the bigger organizations, but in general, kind of hasn't quite so unionized. And I think there's quite a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that there's something about working in an organization where kind of everybody is or thinks they're there for a good reason, that makes it both difficult for, sometimes difficult for people to kind of ask for what they need in terms of pay or terms and conditions, and also makes it hard to ask for a formalized union or to feel like that's kind of necessary. And it can lead to like a lot of exploitation and poor conditions in the sector. This is rife, like precarious contracts, low pay, overwork.
Burnout.
Yeah, totally. And because people are often there because they really care about something, like sometimes people kind of accept that, or bosses or employers can kind of justify that by either like, well, we're working with people who are in a like more precarious situation than you, so are you asking for this? Or we're all here for good reasons, like obviously we're trying our best. Like it's kind of all these narratives that are quite difficult. And I think it's really important for people who are working in this industry to remember that we are like, we're still workers, we're not martyrs, and it's not helpful for anybody for people to be burnt out, for there to be poor conditions. And if we accept that as a sector, we actually like, it actually has a big impact on who can work here, because it's often people who have a certain amount of security, whether that's kind of like financial or housing, etc., that or don't have dependents, that can accept that precarity or that low pay, and that can mean that the sector ends up being dominated by people with like certain life experience. And so I think it is like it's an important thing for us to be doing, to be pushing for better conditions kind of across that sector. And for us, when we went through the process of unionization, I think as an organization, like a lot of our staff are quite political, they're quite kind of, you know, they're campaigners, they've got that kind of mindset. So it maybe wasn't like the hardest sell.
Right. Yeah.
Every organization, like, that might not be the case in every organization. But there was still quite a big process of kind of education around like why a union is useful and important. So we had some of the people from the not-for-profit Unite branch come into the organization and talk to people about what a union is and why. And we ran like quite a lot of one-on-one conversations and group conversations to kind of explore that. And I think it was partly like in our organization there was quite a lot of kind of consultation of staff, I think that's probably also true for a lot of organizations across the sector, so maybe a sense that staff did have a voice. Actually, one of the big things that we kind of were saying and we've kind of learned through the process is that there's a big difference between being consulted as individuals and being an organized collective.
That's crucial.
It's crucial, and the thing that you gain is power, right? And and it means that if one person has an issue or like something's impacting one person, then we can all stand behind that. And we're not kind of siloed out into like making our own like complaints or suggestions.
Power of representation, safeguarding identities as well. But that was, yeah, that was a fascinating breakdown, especially like the term martyr, of that kind of culture of burnout, of, you know, we all have progressive ideals and we're in a nonprofit or an NGO and, you know, we're all here for the right reasons. And, you know, just this kind of, you see in activist circles as well, people just pushing themselves way beyond their boundaries because they feel like they just have to make all these sacrifices in order to like keep doing what they're doing and like help change the world. And you kind of lose the idea of fair working conditions in all of that, which is actually the world we want to live in. You know, it's actually one that has fair working conditions and good relationships between everyone that's working together. So yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to hear about that in the third sector. And I had a follow-up question because I know there's many people that maybe are thinking about working in the third sector if they're young, or are thinking that they can continue their activism but want to make difference and want to kind of be a part of maybe the policy structures or the adjacent organizations that maybe help comment on change and do research and help to inform government, and maybe are thinking about a job in the third sector. So I just wanted to check in with you about what was that continuity like between being like an activist, being on strikes, and then moving into the third sector. Did that interrupt that activism, change it in any way, or did you find that there was continuity?
Yeah, that's a big question. I think there's a whole question about the kind of like professionalization of activism as well, and kind of what that does to a movement. And that's a question in itself that's like really, really valid to talk about. I think for me, because my role is quite like movement building support based, like I try to see myself as a bit of a like resource for a movement. So be like supporting, like adding value, providing resources, training, funding where possible, that kind of thing to a movement that has the kind of autonomy and the, yeah, that creates the direction for itself, as opposed to like, the kind of,
so you're on tap, you know,
rather than imposing what people do, because it's really important, and there's a lot of strength in that coming from the grassroots rather than that coming from like a funded organization. But the things that we can offer is those things I said before, but also the policy, the research, that kind of like, we have people who are spending a lot of time doing that, so the information as well, and trying to like get those communication channels really smooth, like into a movement of people who are doing incredible work. Definitely for me, when especially when I was younger, like that was quite a hard transition, because I was also involved in loads of stuff. And so then you create this kind of dynamic where like sometimes you're in a space as an employee, as a worker, and sometimes you're there as like a volunteer and an activist, and the power dynamics and the expectations that puts on you kind of get a bit complicated. And it meant that I had to take quite a big step back from doing a lot of at least climate voluntary and activism stuff, because I do think that those distinctions are quite important. It's not always super smooth, for sure.
It's not always a hard separation, isn't it? I mean, it would take us a whole podcast to really get into this question, like you said, right? But like, you know, the ideal world, we obviously live in a very less than ideal world, but our activism and our professional lives, our need to actually, you know, live in this society which forces us into employment, you know, how do those two things coexist? Is there continuity? And we would love to find continuity between our activism and our things that bring us money, but it's all so difficult, and maybe sometimes a hard separation is necessary between those two things for the vast majority of us anyway. But yeah, thanks for sharing those insights, Kate. And I wondered if you had any last comments about third sector unionizing, or to anyone that has yet to join a union in their workplace, you know, what are the benefits? What are the reasons?
Yeah, I would say that one thing I hear a lot is we don't need a union because we're really small, like a lot, particularly in Scotland, like a lot of third sector organizations are really small. Like we're quite small, we've got like 20 staff, which is bigger than a lot of other organizations for sure. But in comparison to, you know, a lot of NGOs. That's, it's quite small. And I would say that actually there's something really powerful about having a union in an organization of that size, because it means that you get to be like super democratic. Like, we make all our decisions by consensus when we can. And like I was saying before, it means that if there's an issue that is, yeah, impacting a couple of people or one person because of, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, like parental leave or something that's affecting someone because of their disability or whatever it is, it means that we have the kind of small enough group in the space to hear that and to really kind of work on it together and come up with ideas, like with solutions that work. And sometimes I would like, I definitely think that being unionized has been really beneficial for the organization as well, because it means that even if there is a like non-ideal situation, if we have all the information and we have the space and the time to kind of discuss it as a collective, then we can come to the kind of compromises that maybe an employer might come to anyway.
Yeah.
But we can kind of come to that collectively. Mm-hmm. And it means that, yeah, some of the things that might could be potential sources of tension in an organization are actually, can be kind of collectively agreed upon. So, for instance, with something like an inflationary pay increase, like it could be the case that our organization like actually just doesn't have the budget to give everyone a full inflationary pay increase. And we all also don't want the organization to go bust, right? So that's important to us. But it means that we can come up with alternatives. So one of the things that we've done over the last couple of years in that kind of situation is negotiate a kind of staggered pay increase. So that we're on the lowest bands get a higher percentage increase than people who are on the highest bands.
Oh, great result. Yeah.
And that means that some people have agreed to get a lower percentage of pay increase, right? But they've collectively agreed that with their colleagues and to a level that is comfortable to them. So it means that like we have made a compromise, but we've agreed it together.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. All for that.
I would say that even if your organization is kind of like a nice place to work, having a union can be a really good way to solve those collective problems or to even just create a kind of peer-to-peer support system.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe a lot of people's experience of seeing unions is, you know, when workplace disputes have got to strike level.
Yeah. So
that's last resort for a lot of unions. And actually the day-to-day is negotiation and problem solving, basically. And so
human beings communicating, building relationships.
That union busting narrative that we're like creating this like really tense culture, like it doesn't have to be that. So if your organization is a nice place to work, a kind of like smaller organization, there's not like huge tensions between management and staff, then it still is probably a useful thing. And if there is big tensions and there is bad treatment, then you definitely need a union.
Then you definitely need a union. But I love that framing. But even if it's nice, it's unions are just simply democratic. It's just sharing transparency, building channels of communication, you know, channels of relationships of trust between different workers in different situations, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be that constantly hostile and combative. That's so true. That's so true. That is the union busting narrative that we've all grown up with anyway, of like, oh, as soon as I join a union, then everyone's going to think that I'm like some sort of like, you know, militant, or I'm just, you know, hate my workplace and whatever. And it's just, that's not the case. You know, it's just building democratic cultures. So thanks for that, Kate. Really, really fascinating.
All right. Nice to speak to you.
Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by Young Friends of the Earth Scotland, a network of young activists fighting for climate and social justice. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.